Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do your children understand the dangers of the world outside the safety of your care, and how can we teach them to be vigilant without making them afraid? Many of us were warned as kids not to talk to strangers, but we understand today that it is possible for children to be harmed even by people they know, and that in fact the vast majority of child abductions are committed by relatives or by non-family members who are in some way known to the child. And today's kids also need protection from online predators and cyberbullies, even as they develop the skills to safely learn and engage with others online. Rebecca Bailey is a family psychologist and founder of the organization Transitioning Families. Her new book, written with psychiatric nurse Elizabeth Bailey, is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents: What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. Rebecca, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me on today.
So this book is personal to you for reasons that go even beyond the work you do. You share that you actually knew as a child two different girls who disappeared, but that nobody really gave you much information about what had happened. How did that affect you?
Well, it's interesting because I pretty much had kept it to myself and was something I was worried about, thought about, but for whatever reason never really talked about it in the family. And about 3 years ago, my sister Elizabeth was visiting, and we started talking about what I saw was sort of this lifelong interest in abduction cases. And she acknowledged to me how terrorized she had been by the same situations. And it just was interesting. We were very close as sisters, but we had never really talked about it. So I think when you ask how it affected by making us really scared.
Yeah. Well, you know, child abduction, of course, is one of those crimes that many parents find hard to even think about. On the other hand, if we let ourselves dwell on it too much, we can be reluctant to ever let our kids out of our sight or out of the house. Is there a right amount to worry about these things on behalf of our kids?
Well, I think that the key word is not to worry and not to be afraid, but to help your kids have skills. And I love the analogy of you go to the local pool when your child is little and you put them in floaties and you sit right there and you watch. And then in time you slowly move back and you read a magazine, you glance up frequently, and then eventually you're able to sit and read a novel and know that your child's okay. Mm-hmm. And then at some point you let them go to the pool by themselves. And that's the same thing when we're talking about abduction and safety tips for kids. We've got to give them the knowledge and the information to help them use good judgment out in the greater world. And we shouldn't be afraid of it because, as we all know, knowledge is power.
The other place, of course, parents want to strike the proper balance is in encouraging kids to have, good practices so that they're safe and yet not creating the impression that the world is this, like, universally dangerous and terrible place.
Yes, and I think that's really important. And that was a bit of a challenge when we first undertook this particular book, was, you know, how do you talk about this without scaring people? And the reason we do talk about our experience as children was that whether we talk about it or not, our children are aware of it. And now, even more than ever, you have Amber Alerts on the highway, you have, you know, tabloids with sensational headlines that the kids see, and then they talk about it in school. So by having conversations about it, by creating problem-solving skills for even things like, you know, if you're walking down the street and somebody wants directions, giving kids permission to not go up to the car window, I think helps kids feel safer in the world.
Yeah, one thing that comes up in the book is teaching them to know when it's all right to sort of defy an adult or someone who would seem to be an authority figure for their own safety.
That's the Never Mind Your Manners chapter.
Right.
And it's a tricky one. I mean, one of our buzz lines is, you know, teach your kids to be critical, which I've raised five children, Chris, and I think I've done a good job with that. but on the other hand, you want your kids to respect authority. You want them to understand that there are rules in society. But what we're also saying is that you are allowed to take a step to keep yourself safe. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age of GPSs and cell phones that tell you exactly how to go where, it really is okay to not cross the street. Now, in my famous client, J.C. Dugard's case, no one would ever blame her for what happened, but she did go up to the window believing that this couple was asking for directions, mm-hmm. of which they pretended they were.
Yeah.
Now, do I think we can go back in time and change that? Of course not. But allowing a kid to step to the other side of the road mm-hmm. and feel like they don't have to go up to that car window could be a life-saving event. Rare, certainly, that these things happen, but also important to let kids know that.
Yeah, you know, I've always told my kids, anyone who understands kids or cares about them will not be offended if you don't recognize them and you run the other way.
Yeah, that's great, and I think that's absolutely wise. I mean, really the take-home that we want to start teaching kids is be aware, be smart, be wise, pay attention. We use the practicing being alert, which is a game we've created for little guys where they can go out and pretend they're a mythical character called an alert. It's a play on Woody Allen's alert statement. And you teach them that you teach them through fun how to be aware.
Well, let's talk about that because I love that part of the book. Firstly, because it's hard to sort of explain, you know, bad guys might not look like bad guys and mm-hmm. good guys might not look like good guys, but you can teach kids from a very early age to be aware of things that don't look as they normally do and that somehow should raise a heightened sense of alert.
Yes, and I think again, it's the encouraging just playing that word awareness again. The alert game, which is in the book, also goes along with I Spy. When we were all kids, or many of us were kids, our parents played the I Spy game. It's kind of out of vogue these days. And playing games like that allows kids to take a stock of their environment, what's around them. So you don't do it in this big, scary, horrible way. You just support the notion that being aware, being wise, paying attention is a good, important thing. It's a good skill to have, and it's a fun skill to have.
So you mentioned your patient, J.C. Dugard, and her case obviously is the one that, you know, we are just terrified of, that a stranger comes up and sort of snatches a child. As it turns out, what are called atypical abductions are actually quite rare, but not necessarily that we shouldn't be comforted by the fact that most abductions are, you know, conducted by a parent.
No, we shouldn't be, because any abduction is a frightening abduction. And by the way, the reason I mentioned JC is that she encourages me and supports me to go out and get a message out there, because she doesn't want anyone to go through what she went through. And she's busy living her life quietly and really supports people using her story so people can learn from it. So back to your observation, no, we shouldn't be necessarily comforted by the atypical ones being so unusual. We need to, again, understand that often children are put in the middle of battlegrounds. And when they're put in the middle of battlegrounds, they can get put into a war that they don't have the skills to deal with. For example, custody battles, etc. In the international scene in Europe, we know that familial abductions the numbers are much higher than over here. What they do in some areas in Europe is they do try to get the families to problem solve after, to really sit down. They treat it not so much as a criminal, but as a familial problem with some criminal elements. But I have worked with many, many families where there has been a familial abduction, and I can tell you, for that parent, the left-behind parent, it is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because they also know the rage that the other parent may be experiencing towards them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very complex.
And of course, there's also, you know, when we think about the good of the kids here, you know, for children who've been through an experience like this, there's already so much, you know, conflict and doubt when parents are not getting along and not together, that to add this in and have the child ever asking himself or herself, did I do something wrong here, has got to be awful.
I agree. It really does have to be awful. Part of our program, Transitioning Families, we just really focus on demanding that families focus on the kids and problem solve within the family, because it is awful for these little guys. It's really frightening.
So one rule that you encourage really from the moment children are mature enough to be outside or away from home without adults is that they never go anywhere alone. You know, go with a friend, go with a sibling. Does the presence of a second child deter potential abductors?
Not necessarily. I think the safety in numbers is a little bit erroneous. But particularly with the older kids, we do absolutely, with the young guys, we say, don't be out of sight of your parents.
Right.
Because this is how it is, unfortunately. You know, gone are the days you can play in the meadow with nobody glancing up at you. I'm sure there still are some areas, but still kind of an iffy situation. But part of being with a friend is even the problem-solving value, the ability to kind of check and recheck each other.
Like, that's not such a good idea. Let's not go over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we encourage that conversation. I mean, so much of this book is about communication with children and communicating in age-appropriate ways. So, again, it's not about scaring. It's just allowing communication and putting the issues on the table.
Yeah, and I want to go back to that point that you made earlier because I think it's worth underscoring. Just because, you know, if a terrible event happened and it's been on the news, just because your kids don't mention it doesn't mean they haven't heard about it.
That's absolutely right. One of the stories in the book is a friend of mine on the East Coast. The child absolutely, they kept all of the 9/11s. They don't have TV. They really believe they were keeping 9/11 out of the consciousness of the child. And one day they were out in the backyard, and I think it was about 6 months after, and the child looked up. And a plane was going over and said, you know, Mommy, is that a good guy or a bad guy?
Hmm.
And in that moment, she realized that she really had to talk to the child. You know, there are parents that have no media in their home, and that's an individual choice. But absolutely, the news is in the air. It's everywhere. No matter what environment, it's very hard to keep children from at least having some knowledge of something, and often it's wrong. They'll have a really incorrect assumption about something, so you're almost better to talk about it. You are better to talk about it, not almost, sorry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Angie in Louisville. Hi, Angie.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
Okay, I was just calling because it just amazes me sometimes with my son, who is 9, whenever I have to have those conversations with him, just how receptive he is to them. It's just, he just seems to really, really get it sometimes. And it'll be about things that I am scared to talk to him about because I don't want him to be afraid to leave the house.
That's really interesting. Is that your experience, Rebecca, with lots of families that you work with?
Absolutely. I love that, Angie, because we go into them. I do a group in middle schools on working with kids sort of on awareness, and I cannot believe how much these kids want to talk about the things that they're experiencing, seeing, and problem solving. So that's been exactly my experience. These kids have a lot to say on this subject and a lot of questions.
My guest is Rebecca Bailey. She's a family psychologist and founder of the organization Transitioning Families. Her new book is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents: What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. We'll come back to this conversation and take more of your calls in a moment. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also participate in the show via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is family psychologist Rebecca Bailey. Her new book, written with Elizabeth Bailey, is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents: What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Rebecca, one of the things you recommend is that we as parents step back and take a look at our style with regard to communicating about these issues with our children and also communicating about the rules and how they'll be enforced with regard to safety.
Absolutely. It's really important. On the first point, if you discuss with children these events, these kind of events in the world that are frightening and scary, and you approach it with anxiety, what it does is it inflicts it back to them. So you have to be extremely careful with how you explain it, and remembering constantly that we're role models for our children.
Mm-hmm. So what happens if, for some reason, you really want to be honest and communicate things, and, you know, every once in a while you'll have a child get really obsessed with something and very, you know, freaked out. If you feel like somehow you've gone too far, how do you help that child step back and feel safe in the world but also empowered to take steps toward his or her own safety?
Well, one of the things that I do like to do is, depending also on the age of the child, I really do like to take stock in my home, and this is talking of from the parent perspective, of the good things in the world. Mm. It's really important, the positive things that I've seen. And also reassuring kids that these events are rare. They're sensational, but they're rare. Children, what I found in that group I mentioned earlier that we were doing in a local school, these kids had so many concerns about Sandy Hook. I mean, who doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I'm seeing is that kids in schools these days are worried about things that we just didn't have to think about. But talking to them, talking about the good things, reminding them of the positive forces that are there is really important.
One thing you're adamant about is that we should never send a stranger, someone our child does not know at all, to say, pick them up after gymnastics or soccer or school.
Yes, and I know that in this day and age, and being a working mom, I had times that, you know, I'd be stuck with a kid at the school and something would come up. It's important to have what we call a safety list,
mm-hmm.
which is a list of people that your child knows that are okay. And, for example, for pickups, for example, in my community, I had three or four parents of my children's friends that they knew in a pinch could be there, plus another friend of mine. So to send an absolute stranger, you're better off. I mean, you shouldn't do it, because mm-hmm. your kids need to be very clear that they know who their safe people are.
Yeah. And I guess it's also important that kids have people that they feel they can talk to besides just mom and dad.
Absolutely. I have a friend of mine who refers to those people as cookie people. And the cookie people are the people that make you feel good, like your grandma used to when she'd give you a warm chocolate chip cookie and a safe place to sit down and just connect.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important that kids have other people in their life that are separate, yes.
So a lot of what we've talked about seems to make perfect sense when you're raising your kids up through elementary school, and then you get into middle school and they want to push back, and then they get into high school and they don't want any rules at all. You mentioned the importance of age-appropriate rules and conversations. How do you shift gears when your kids are in high school and they resent the fact that there are any rules?
Well, you know that that's going to happen. And in my book, if you're doing your job as a parent, there's going to be a pushback, and they're going to be frustrated with you. Anybody that thinks that the teenage years are a piece of cake and your kids are going to be happy with the rules that you make, have a very rare child. I'm sure there's some out there, but I never found one of those in my home. It's sort of, in a way, it's a little like fishing. Mm-hmm. You reel in a little, and then you let out a little. And you have to be having a dialogue. And that's why in our book, we're really encouraging these conversations start early, so that by the time that your kids get into middle school and high school, they're used to some of these conversations, understanding that they change. Somebody once told me that teenagers are like dogs that turn into cats. A little kid is like a dog. They come when called, and they eat the dog food you give them, and then suddenly they turn into cats. They don't want to come when they're called, and they don't like anything you feed them. And I think that's somewhat true.
Mm-hmm.
So you're changing a little bit your approach, but you're still being clear.
Yeah. And a lot of people worry about infringing on their kids' privacy or worrying that their kids will think they don't trust them. But you say passwords for the cell phone, the email, the social media account, parents should expect to have a copy of those.
I'm not 100% adamant that for example, and let me give the real life example. I have a 17-year-old daughter. My sister, who wrote the book with me, she has access, she has her passwords, and she has access to her, she's a friend on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I made a decision to let my sister Lisa do that as opposed to me for just some of the reasons that, while my daughter was developing her own sense of self.
Yeah.
So I think there's ways around it. I don't want to be overly intrusive in kids' faces all the time, particularly 16, 17, 18-year-olds, but safety is really important. You need to know who they're talking to. You need to have a clarity on what is their definition of friend. You know, in the book we talk about one child who had 955 friends on Facebook. Well, that opens a whole new definition of what friendship is.
Hmm.
So again, these conversations, what is a friend? What does a friend look like? You know, what is a friend in your life is really important.
You know, the thing that my kids are getting to be teenagers now, and I always think about, you know, you want them to tell you the truth and you want to have clear parameters. But if you make the rules too strict, I always worry that you encourage them to lie to you and do what they want to do anyway. Have you figured out a solution to that, like, you know, spending the night with a friend?
I think just as much as we want our children to be alert, we have to be alert, too.
Uh-huh.
But I'm with you 100%, Chris, that, you know, if we overly micromanage, we're going to get kids that are either they can get sneakier and sneakier. I think we have to understand that kids will make mistakes. They will do quote unquote stupid things, but they need to know that we are aware and that we're watching and that yes, there's appropriate consequences when something happens. We hope that they're 100% honest with them. I think the majority of kids aren't 100% honest. Do I think they're 100% mistruthful? No, I don't. I think there's a lot of great teenagers out there. But again, each child is different. Being clear what our expectations are, being aware, is really important. It's crucial. There's no set formula. But
yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to ask, what does it take to help them, as we're keeping them safe all this time, to also help them develop some resiliency and some sense that they are responsible for themselves?
Well, that's why I believe, and my sister and I both believe so strongly, that starting conversations early, giving kids knowledge and power, I think the number one inoculator is love.
Mm-hmm.
Letting your kids know that you love them, that yes, there will be times that they disappoint you, and yes, there will be times that you're irritated with them or even angry with them, but the overall message is love.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole notion of unconditional love does not mean unconditional acceptance of everything they do.
Okay, so back to the little guys. I mean, I think stranger danger is pretty easy to communicate, and we can get that message across. Unfortunately, anybody who has, you know, picked up a newspaper or been online to read the news recognizes that sometimes children are severely harmed by people who not only are known to them, but who are believed by a lot of other adults in the family to be harmless, good people. Can you talk about ways to sort of arm our children to communicate if something really dangerous is going on with someone that we as adults don't suspect?
Okay, but first, if you don't mind, I'm going to step back to stranger danger,
okay.
Which is we really try not to use that term anymore.
Oh.
And I actually have been educating when I just did some media on the East Coast. I was educating all those folks back there about it because the term stranger danger connotes that somebody that looks different than me is dangerous.
Hmm.
So we try to use words like it's hard to come up with such a catchy phrase, but explaining to kids that it's someone unknown to you often, just because they look like you doesn't mean they're a safe person.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's come in recently. There was a young boy who tragically was killed in Brooklyn, New York. And what he did was he got lost, and he went to the car of a man that dressed in the same traditional garb of the group that he lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up, sadly, being murdered by that individual. So we really try to change that. So I just want to, I keep trying to come up with another term to replace it, and I don't have it yet.
But, I definitely appreciate the distinction. Yeah.
So, okay, so to refocus me, can you rephrase
sure.
the next,
right,
the
okay.
next part of the
Well, and I'll rephrase it without using that phrase, but children know maybe to be, we can teach them to be a little cautious around people they have not met before, right? Mm-hmm. Someone that doesn't, hasn't made their acquaintance. On the other hand, sometimes kids are victimized by an uncle, a priest, a neighbor, that sort of thing.
A coach, et cetera.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. A trusted figure.
So what we want to do is keep the communication open with the kids on that whole notion, if something doesn't feel right, if something makes you uncomfortable, that's also the never mind your manners. If your kid says, I don't like to sit in Uncle So-and-so's lap, we want to talk to them. We want to encourage that conversation and encourage them to tell it, to let them know that that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a change with my children, and it's a little bit hard to do. But from very early on, I would hear these unfortunately these like awful situations that you'd read in the paper about maybe a local figure like a priest and. I'd sort of bring it up to them and talk to them, even when they were younger, about what had happened, but in a way that wasn't just really terrifying. And when they were really little, they'd say, well, why would somebody be okay with that?
Hmm.
And we'd have that conversation. So, again, we're talking about opening these conversations.
Go ahead, please.
Making it safe for them to have a conversation with us.
And if parents start to suspect that something has gone wrong, and these are all, you know, sort of the God forbid situations, but if parents yeah. suspect something's gone wrong, should you say to the child, did this specific thing happen to you, or do you leave that open-ended and let them communicate to you?
Well, depending on the particular child and the age, but I have also found when people say, and I don't advocate lying to children, but when you use a story and say, this happened to a friend of mine's child,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they're more likely to say, oh, that happened to me too.
Huh.
And I've had in my private practice more than one case where the parent approached it that way.
Yeah.
I heard about this happening. I don't think it's an anomaly that I have dealt with many kids in my private practice early on, which has changed a lot over the years, more to be a family focus, but it used to be much more individual. There, I've dealt with a lot of kids that have had very, and I use this word, icky. That's my,
mm-hmm.
I'm coining the phrase, icky situations happen from the range of, you know, a fondling situation to worse. And sometimes I would be the first person that they would talk to about it, or because they would feel like it was something they couldn't speak to parents about. And these are kids with pretty good relationships with parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, talk to them about it.
And I guess when in doubt, if you're not sure, seek professional help?
Yep. When in doubt, check it out. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Shelley in Richardson. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, and thank you very much for this topic. My son is 6 years old and just finished kindergarten. And I really went to great pains to keep him from hearing about what happened at Sandy Hook. And so now I'm hearing your comments about that, you know, we need to talk to our kids, and they may already know about it. He's very anxiety prone as it is, and I didn't want him to be afraid to go to school. So I don't know how, if he doesn't know, I don't want to bring it up to him. And if he already knows, I feel like he would have told me that he knew about it because he's prone to being scared. But I just, is the advice the same for six-year-olds? I mean, that young? I'm just not sure what to do about that.
I love the question in that what it brings up is, again, individual differences. Now, it's rare. Every school tries to deal with this differently, but many of the schools that I've had contact with, the kids did hear about it because another child would talk.
Rebecca, are you with us? Okay, it looks like we've lost the connection with Rebecca Bailey. We will get her back on the line for you in a minute. Rebecca Bailey is my guest. She's a family psychologist and founder of the organization Transitioning Families. Her new book, which she wrote with psychiatric nurse and her sister, Elizabeth Bailey, is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents, What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. Perhaps we can go into our break here a minute early while we get Rebecca back on the phone. But I'll remind you of that phone number, 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Rebecca, we have you back on the line?
Are you there?
I am. I'm sorry about that. Somehow we lost you. So you were talking about individual differences among children and whether children had very often heard about situations like Sandy Hook.
Right, and I really like the caller's call because what we're saying is, okay, you know, let's pay attention to each of our child's differences. I just would like her to keep aware that her child may have heard more because particularly if the child's in a school, just sort of pay attention. And it sounds like she already is, but but little bit of, well, how do you feel in school? You know, you can even go as far as to say, do you ever get scared in school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, without absolutely implanting. But I love that she's paying attention to her own child. My issue in California, where we are, is that many of the schools came right out and held assemblies and told the younger kids, which I actually, despite what I'm saying in the book, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's really best dealt with in the home with families talking and doing exactly what she's doing, paying attention to her child.
Rebecca Bailey is my guest. She's a family psychologist and founder of Transitioning Families. Her new book is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents, What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes, and you are welcome to join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is family psychologist Rebecca Bailey. She's founder of the organization Transitioning Families and co-author of the new book Safe Kids, Smart Parents, What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone here to Mary in Dallas. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I have a question, I have a grandchild. I have two, actually. And for some reason, when my little grandbaby was starting to talk, they didn't want her to be left alone with me because I guess she was talking. And I found out they had a lot of problems. But, you know, I get to see her every now and then, and she talks to me. But last time when she was over at my house, when we get in the room, we were playing with the balls, and her brother is there. She always tells me to close the door. And she always wants me to close the door and I kept thinking, why does she do that? I think it's because she wants her parents not to come in, to be criticized or be told, because this is what, unfortunately, my son-in-law does. He criticizes her a lot, and he punishes her for really a lot of stupid reasons. And I just wanted to know, how can I reach out to her, or how I can get her to open up to me more?
Yeah, Rebecca.
You know, don't underestimate what you're doing. You are, as I said earlier, a cookie person for her. You are providing a wonderful place where she feels comfortable. Be careful to not over-speculate what it is about why she feels this way. It may be that you just feel like the safest place in the whole world for her. So what I would say is keep doing exactly what you're doing. That's wonderful.
Yeah,
you're a warm blanket with her.
And what about, you know, kids that we may know, friends of our children, if we have concerns that they're not okay, is the first person to approach their parent?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Sometimes a school counselor is also a good way to go, or a church. You know, if you're in a church community, the pastor, somebody like that. I would love to say that absolutely the first place to go is a parent, but unfortunately there are some parents that are exactly not the person to go to. So, again, individual difference on this. The vast majority, probably you could go to a parent. But, you know, sometimes if you think a kid is being abused in a home, physically, emotionally, mentally, by going to that parent, it creates more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, look for people within the community, within the so-called village, that might be someone to say, hey, you know, I've got a concern. Are you seeing the same things?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Sharmina in Richardson. Hi, Sharmina.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was actually calling because I have four kids. My two older ones I don't have to worry about so much. But my four-year-old and my six-year-old boys have absolutely no fear of just wandering off, opening the front door, and going outside to play. And, you know, if we go out in the mall or the store or anything, it's like, really hard to just kind of make them understand that, you know, there are strangers and you have to be careful. So
I call those guys, I've raised five children, and I call the two that I had my butterfly chasers. They were always chasing butterflies. And what I can tell you is sit down with them and even try to give them simple guidelines. I mean, it's going to take time. It really is going to take time. If I had to count the times that I chased after my middle stepson, it would just knock your socks off. But talk with them and don't say, you know, it's really scary. People are going to grab you. Just say, hey, there's certain rules of the road. And one of them is, you know, you need to be able to be, I need to be able to see where you are. So you just want to keep the conversation. You can also try the game thing with them. You know, you can say, okay, I'm going to, sounds kind of silly and I'm thinking on the top of my head, but I'm going to give you a quarter if you notice something in my right hand when we're out. And, you know, you could have a little something in your hand that's hard to see. And so make it a game as much as possible. You just, what you're trying to teach them is awareness and alertness, but you don't want to infuse them with fear because bless their little hearts, we need butterfly chasers. We just need them to be safe.
One thing we don't want to do for those butterfly chasers or anybody else, and this is really interesting, is buy them backpacks and caps and shirts with their names printed on them.
You know, and I feel when we wrote that chapter, I feel so badly saying that because there are some great products out there, but just remembering what the reason we talk about that is called a foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on an age, a kid can respond if they have their name and they're in the store and somebody says, hey, Andy, hi. Kids aren't going to process back that, geez, that's written on the back of my shirt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you do have a child wearing some of that, a team shirt or something, talk with them about it at least. I think you're better not to,
mm-hmm.
But talk with them about it.
You know, the other thing is, and this comes up in the book, we think about little kids, younger children being sort of lured with some candy or, look, I have a puppy. But as you write about, you know, an older child, someone can say, I've got a brand new bike that maybe you want it and come to the truck and look at it. Can you talk about that?
Yes. And that was a situation with my butterfly chaser, mm-hmm. that when I know we'd finally gotten through with him at 11, he came into the house and said somebody had come asked him, do you want a bike, a brand new bike? I'm going to take it to the dump. And he had run in the house for whatever reason he was really thinking that day and talked to me. And by the time I went out to to go see what was going on, the car pulled off.
Hmm.
In the book, we say, was it just a nice guy with a bike? It could have been, but I don't want to chance that.
Yeah. Yeah, and anybody who drives off before mom has the chance to come out and see what's up, is you have to wonder about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I've had more than one experience. I feel sometimes like part of my role on this earth is to educate on this because I've had more than one experience with my own personal kids
mm-hmm.
where a situation like this has happened. So, and I can't imagine I'm the only person.
What kind of rules do you set up for children who, as they start to get older, are able to stay alone for a little while? You know, in our house growing up, it was always just don't open the door, don't answer the door, pretend you're not home. Is that still good advice?
It is good advice. We also know that sometimes no matter what we say to the kids, they're still going to do it. So part of, and I also believe that, you know, depending on the developmental age of the child, that there is certainly a time that you can run to the store. I think with each of my kids, it was a different age. I had one that was 11. You know, I'm talking about running out for an hour, and I had one that was 9.
Mm-hmm.
But you do go over those rules again, and those rules are important. No, you don't open the door. Again, never mind your manners. You don't have to open it. We also know that one of the things some of the media, one of the other stations is doing a whole subject on kid safety, and they're actually showing kids how easily they'll walk off from the playground. And they contacted with a stranger, which there I'm using the stranger word, but they were concerned that it was traumatizing. They did warn the parents ahead of time. I also said that it was the best possible thing that other children could see because you want them to see, you want it to be real to them. So you look at this and you say, see, that's a normal response, but still, what do you do if someone comes up to you at the playground or someone says there's a puppy? We have a chapter in the book called There Is No Puppy.
Mm-hmm.
These kids, no matter how many times you tell them, their first response, many of them, is, oh, let's go find the puppy.
Right.
So if you practice with them a little bit, talk about it, even if you can get your hand on some of these media videos, it's a great tool.
Talk about this, Rebecca. A lot of parents now are getting cell phones for their children at, you know, younger and younger ages and
yes.
feel like that's a tool for safety, which I suppose it can be. But are they making us falsely confident?
I think we are, because I think the key to keeping kids safe is education, knowledge, love, communication. And I think, yeah, so cell phones are communication, but like any great thing, it takes time and repetition. And so just assuming that this cell phone is how it's going to keep you safe. I will also tell you, with teenagers, cell phones often open the door to more problems because you're not communicating with the families where you know your child says they're over at XYZ's house. They're on their cell phone, and they're not at XYZ's house.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it a little bit harder for kids for parents to stay up on what's happening with their children, which is why the whole notion of having careful conversations early on over a period of time is so important.
And you say it's a good idea to sort of check in on those cell phone use records once in a while.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Not only to see if they're up in the middle of the night on the cell phone. You'd be surprised how many hours these kids can log texting.
Oh, it sounds like we have lost Rebecca again. We will get her back and finish out this hour for you. My guest is a family psychologist and founder of the organization Transitioning Families, Rebecca Bailey. She's written a new book with her sister, who is a psychiatric nurse. Her sister is Elizabeth Bailey. And the book is called Safe Kids, Smart Parents: What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. You can be part of the conversation. Maybe share a story of your own at 1-800-933-5372. Or you can join the conversation via email to think@kera.org. Again, the subject of our conversation this hour is what parents need to know to keep their children safe from a variety of hazards. The best ways to educate your children to look out for themselves and make sure that they are always okay. I think we have Rebecca Bailey back on the line with us now. Hi, Rebecca.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. So anyway, what happened was, it's funny that the phone gremlins are telling us not to limit the teenagers' use of phones.
That's right. That's what I thought, too.
But you were saying that they can log crazy amounts of time on these things in the middle of the night, in addition to anything that might be truly dangerous to them.
Yes, And you can, so you can get parental controls, et cetera. And then also part of growing up is learning self-regulation. And I, again, know from other people's children and certainly from my own that self-regulation is very difficult. And so helping, sometimes a kid will need a little help where, you know, the cell phone, the texting capacity goes off at 9.
Yeah. Any special rules for dealing with the, you know, 9-year-old friend who's allowed to go to the mall alone and, you know, your children who absolutely are not allowed to do those things?
You know, I think we have to, we also, when we're talking 9 years old, we need to talk to the other parent. And I, you know, you just, you've got to hold the line in your house on what feels right for you. I personally would not send a 9-year-old to the mall under any circumstances.
Right.
I had my own challenges with a 15-year-old who came home one day and had told me that this nice man had bought him lunch on more than one occasion, and actually was talking to him about, he's now 24, about this the other day, and how he honestly thought this man was a nice man that wanted to buy him lunch.
Yeah.
And years later we look at it and we go, ugh. It's the same butterfly kid.
Well, I'm glad he's made it to 24. And
you know, I feel the same way.
Sounds like he's done all right. I mean, I guess what I love about this, too, is the idea that, you know, one kid may really absorb this and sort of make good decisions from an early age, and others are going to need constant reminders. But I suppose no matter what, it's, for no child is it one conversation, this big momentous thing. It has to keep happening.
Absolutely. Repetitive and open. And I guess the one thing I may have underestimated is listen to them. Let them educate. I like to say I use Columbo, the old detective from TV, who kind of bumbled around in a case and would find something and say, wonder out loud, what's this, you know, bloody cigar in the corner? Doing that with kids is really important. They need you to listen to them. They need you to ask questions. They need you to initially respond non-judgmentally, and then they need limits.
Yeah. That can be hard, too, that non-judgmental initial reaction.
Trust me, it is hard. I can't at all pretend that I was 100% good on that, but because sometimes my go-to reaction is the exact opposite of what it should be, but that's when you can own up to it and come back and say, hey, I blew it. Can we talk about this again?
So for patients that you've worked with that really have been through these hellish experiences, what does it take for them to begin to rebuild a healthy life for themselves?
You know, it's almost like, again, putting that toe back in the pool. You know, they have to just do it at their pace. It's in the work we do, we use animals, we use an environment where we use cooking, we use different tools to sort of slowly integrate them back into the world. But again, to sound trite, everybody is different, and we have to approach these patients with the knowledge that they adapted to a horrific situation that many of us can't imagine, nor could we imagine coming out as well as they have.
Yeah.
And so we have to let them educate us on what they need.
Rebecca Bailey.
And also to not see them broken.
Rebecca Bailey is a family psychologist and author of the new book, Safe Kids, Smart Parents, What Parents Need to Know to Keep Their Children Safe. Rebecca, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. And thanks for bringing this message out to the world. It's so important.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy, with production assistance from Lindsay Connect and podcast production by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.